The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, this is Brian E. Lau, creator of Staunch Ambition, and you are listening to the PBD Cast by John Orwater. Or wait, Orlando? Yes, John Orlando.
Welcome, everyone, to the 150th installment of the PVD Cast. I am your host, John Orlando, the man that's been your host since day one, and I'm very happy to bring you this monumental milestone of an episode of your favorite podcast, the PVD Cast. And I'm doing something totally different for the 150th episode. I'm doing something very, very experimental, something that I've never done before, but I thought that this might be a good episode to try my hand at creating an encore presentation. My guest for this episode is Chris Bornay. Now, you may have recalled that on episode number 136 last fall, Chris came on this podcast to talk about his documentary that he has produced called Lady Wrestler, The Amazing Untold Story of African-American Women in the Ring. So, Chris has a movie premiere coming up. And I thought, what better way than to reintroduce maybe folks to this great documentary, or maybe introduce some new folks to it by doing an encore presentation. So basically what I did was I took the original recording of Chris and I's conversation, and I'm going to obviously put it after this introduction and put a new outro as well, as they say in the industry, or a closing, to use layman's terms, so to speak. But I want to let you know that next Thursday, March 29th, Chris is having his big movie premiere at the Wexner Center for the Arts, where he's going to show Lady Wrestler. It's going to be at the video theater down there at the complex. It starts at 7 o'clock. You can get tickets online over at wexarts.org. That's wexarts.org. Tickets are $8. If you're a student, if you're a senior citizen, if you're a kid, they're $6. But next Thursday, the 29th, 7 o'clock, the big premiere for Chris Bornay's documentary, and I'm excited for Chris. He's a heck of a nice guy. He's worked incredibly hard on this documentary. As I mentioned during the episode, and you're going to hear it in our conversation, he's dropping a lot of pro wrestling knowledge on me that I didn't even know. So that ought to tell you how spectacular this documentary is going to be. You don't want to miss it, so come on out next Thursday. Catch Chris's movie, Lady Wrestler. I don't think you'll be disappointed, especially if you're a wrestling fan or if you're a historian. You know, this is a lot of Columbus history that's featured in this documentary. So definitely come on out if you get the opportunity to. And with that, I gotta give a little bit of love to our sponsor, Audible, who has been a great sponsor and is bringing you this podcast this week. And I need to let you know that you could get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/PVDcast. As you know, Audible has over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And for you, the listeners of the PVDcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Maybe since we're talking about female wrestlers, maybe you'd like to check out Let's Use Free Speech to Praise Indie Women's Wrestling, a very short book written by Andrew Bushard, narrated by Trevor Klinger. But whatever you're interested in, Audible has a book for you. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/PVDcast. Again, that's audibletrial.com/PVDcast to get your free audiobook. And with that little piece of business done, let's go right on into my conversation with filmmaker Chris Bornay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sitting down here with filmmaker Chris Bornay. Chris, how are you doing tonight?
Great to be here.
Yeah. You got an amazing documentary that's out now, Lady Wrestler, the untold story of African American women in the ring.
Right.
And so let's talk a little bit about just a brief synopsis of what the film is about.
Well, first of all, it's not officially out yet.
My bad.
Yeah,
okay.
I haven't finalized details yet, but there will be a screening, like a big official launch screening, like either in February for Black History Month or March for Women's History Month. Okay. So I haven't confirmed the details yet.
But sorry, because it wasn't focal, and I just assumed that then therefore you were all set to go. And
no. So, released. Yeah, okay. This past year I've been kind of doing trying to do the film festival circuit. So
how has that been, the film festival circuit?
You know what? It's been hit and miss. Focal is interesting because I didn't actually apply to Focal. I sort of got invited. Okay. And so I applied, of course, to all the big ones like Sundance and Toronto and Cannes. I actually went to Cannes. I didn't actually get into Cannes, but there's a they call it the Marché du Film. It's a film marketplace where producers and production companies look for like films or scripts that they want to buy. So I got accepted into that. So I actually had the Cannes experience, walked down the red carpet, saw, you know, Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell.
Really?
Yeah, all these people walking by me. So I got to go to like a lot of the gala screenings and stuff. I just wasn't an official, you know, entry into Cannes. So the festival circuit has really been hit and miss, which I've been kind of surprised at because there was previously, a wrestling documentary about women in the same era called Lipstick and Dynamite, but that only briefly mentioned the African American women. So I thought the African American women deserved their own, you know, their own movie, of course.
Sure.
But that Lipstick and Dynamite movie did extremely well. It played at like Toronto, you know, which is one of the biggest festivals in the world. The director, her name is Ruth, I can't think of her last name, and all the women who were in it were on The Tonight Show. This is back in like the mid-00s. So I'm thinking, you know, this story is even more exceptional because these are African American women who were like, you know, hidden figures. They were totally... They not only had to overcome the perception that women aren't as great athletes as men, but that, you know, Black people are inferior. So there'd be so much interest in this story. And there is interest among, like, movie fans and wrestling fans and just sports fans in general. But it's been really kind of I didn't really get into any of the big festivals, which I was kind of surprised at. Part of that is just kind of, like, inexperience as a filmmaker, because this is my first, like, official film. And part of it is just, I don't know if there's so much competition now because technology has allowed everybody and their brother to be a filmmaker or what it is. But
right. I guess that's one of the bad parts about technology is it makes it easier to make a film, but it lets a lot of people make crappy films.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of been hit and miss then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, again, I apologize. I thought since it was already at Focal that it had already dropped and whatnot. But you're searching out there for an outlet for it, and
I'm not really searching for an outlet. I just decided, you know, I swing for the fences and try to get into the big festivals. Mm-hmm. But my plan is to eventually release it on Amazon and iTunes, and then just kind of have like a DVD and Blu-ray available for people who are like, you know, even that's not a big market anymore. But just for you know, there are some people who like to have collector's items.
Yes. Yes, so, you're looking at one of the guys that does.
I
gotta buy
too.
my movies. That
I like having
gotta
physical
have
product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Same with me. Anyways, we went all over the place.
Yeah, we did.
Synopsis of the documentary.
Yeah, so it's about African American female professional wrestlers who were very successful all over the world in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Women like Ethel Johnson, who I interviewed in the documentary, Ramona Isbell. And Ethel actually had two sisters who were also wrestlers. Ethel was the middle sister. Her older sister Babs got into wrestling first. Then Ethel got into it. Then their younger sister Marva Scott got into it. So I kind of make the comparison in the documentary that Ethel, Marva, and Babs were kind of like the Venus and Serena of their day.
Okay.
They were very, very famous. I mean, they wrestled in Australia, Japan, Mexico, Cuba, all over Latin America.
Okay.
In fact, Ethel had a stage name in Latin America, Rita Valdez. So Montreal, Canada, all over the world.
So how come then we haven't heard about these women?
I
mean, like when you mentioned that, because one of my questions was, you know, were they predominantly a Midwestern territory?
Right.
Is that where they stuck?
Right.
You just rattled off five different countries.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I should first of all back up and say,
okay, sure,
this is not only a piece of like Black history that's been kind of lost, but a piece of Ohio and Columbus history.
Yes.
Because their promoter, which diehard wrestling fans, you know, who are of a certain age, would know that Billy Wolf and Al Haft, they were huge promoters of wrestling, and they were based here in Columbus. Mm-hmm. Al Haft had a huge wrestling facility called Haft Acres in Reynoldsburg. In fact, if you drive down, I think it's Main Street, there's a side street off of Main Street called Haft Acres Boulevard or something like that, because he used to have this big facility, Haft Acres. Billy Wolf had this huge training gym downtown where people from all over the country, like mm-hmm. bodybuilders, wrestlers, mm-hmm. would come and train there. So Billy Wolf was married to Mildred Burke, who was the first women's wrestling champion. Billy and Mildred were both white, and so was Al. But Billy was inspired by Jackie Robinson, who, of course, integrated Major League Baseball. And he thought, okay, one way to make women's wrestling bigger is to allow black women to come into mm-hmm. it. So he started recruiting black women into the sport, and Ethel Babs and Marva were some of the first ones. So the question is, why did they fade into obscurity the way they did? Well, Billy Wolf and Mildred Burke ended up getting divorced. I think it was in either the 50s or 60s. Mildred went on to become like a promoter herself. And then after Billy Wolf died in the 60s, women's wrestling kind of, I mean, it was huge. It was under his direction, it was really huge. So after he died, women's wrestling the popularity kind of waned for a while. Mm-hmm. And so all these women that were, you know, managed by him kind of started going off into, like, a lot of them decided, you know, I'm not making enough money anymore, I'm just going to get a second career. Like Ramona Isbell, who I interviewed, she ended up becoming an administrator for the state of Ohio. She also became a born-again Christian, and for a while felt like, well, I don't want to talk about my wrestling past because, you know, I was wearing skimpy outfits and I was, you know, throwing
as opposed to what they wear today.
Exactly.
I mean,
that's
why I chuckle.
Exactly. Yeah. Throwing people around the ring. And sure. And so a lot of these women were mothers, and like now they're grandmothers, they're retired, and they're just kind of shy about talking about their past.
Wow. But that just blows my mind.
Yeah.
That they were that big, and with all due respect to those women, I'm not trying to belittle them and say, well, you know, it was a territory system, but just, you know, again, I marvel the fact that I have never heard, and I'm a huge wrestling nerd, never really understood or even heard of them. What about, like, you mentioned, you know, Billy Wolf, of course, we can talk a little more about him because he's quite a colorful character.
He really was. I would say he was a more compelling character than anything you'd find in the Marvel or DC universe.
He was very
complex.
He was. But when he died, you said mm-hmm. that, you know, a lot of the women, they lacked a direction, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't another promoter that swooped in. I mean, I'm thinking of the Fabulous Moolah, who was known for, you know, promoting women's wrestling and had a stable of women that she would farm out to different territories and whatnot. I mean, there was no one else there that would swoop in and help them out?
Well, I think there was the Fabulous Moolah, and then Mildred Burke also opened her own wrestling promotion business. And actually, Marva Scott, for a while, was managed by Mildred Burke. But I don't think there was anyone, certainly, I don't know about in the Midwest, but there was certainly no one left in Columbus who was going to take the reins from Billy Wolf. Billy Wolf and Mildred Burke had a son. It was actually Mildred's son from another relationship. But for some reason, Billy Wolf Jr., I think that was his name, didn't step up and take the reins after Billy Wolf died. So it was sort of like Billy Wolf had this one-of-a-kind wrestling factory, and when he died, it just fell apart. Actually, Jeff Lean, he's a Washington Post reporter who wrote a book about Mildred Burke called Queen of the Ring. Mm-hmm. He talks about this formula that Billy Wolf and Mildred Burke created called sex, muscles, and diamonds, meaning the women had to be sexy. When they were outside of the ring, they had to wear glamorous outfits and wear diamonds. And then, you know, of course, the muscles was the athletic ability.
They essentially like Ric Flair.
I mean, essentially, that
gimmick. Well, let's talk more about Billy Wolf, because he is controversial.
Yeah.
Very controversial. Yeah. A womanizer.
Yes.
I mean, well known to...
Yeah.
He's had how many relationships before Mildred Burke?
A couple of ladies?
Several during.
Yeah.
You know, but again, he was the man that just drove women's wrestling to the forefront. In your research, did you ever find out why Billy thought that this was the way to go? That this was... Women's wrestling was going to be the new
the new niche, the new whatever.
Well, I think it was just kind of happenstance because he started out, if I'm correct, as a wrestler himself, and then he wasn't that great of a wrestler, so that wasn't his ticket to fame. And so then when he met Mildred Burke, he kind of saw potential in her, and he thought, well, women wrestling is such a kind of a novelty, almost like a, I mean, women were literally wrestling in circus sideshows, so he thought, well, this is something really unique and something interesting that people will come and see just for the novelty aspect of it. If it's, even if it's just a woman, if it's a woman wrestling another woman, but especially if a woman can wrestle another, can wrestle a man and, you know, manage to defeat him, people are going to be like, wow, that's really, that blows my mind. So he saw it as like this, this sort of form of entertainment that hadn't been tapped into.
Well, and we'll come back to Billy, I'm sure, several times here, but let's talk a little bit about like Ethel and Babs and Marva. They have very strong athletic backgrounds.
Yeah, actually, Babs, as I said, she was the first one who got into the wrestling business. She was recruited by Billy Wolf. And then, but Ethel, her younger sister Ethel, far surpassed her as in athletic ability and also star power. In fact, Ramona Isbell, in her interview, she said Ethel was always the top black star. It just was just one of those things where Ethel was not looking to, she had no idea what professional wrestling was. She was like 15 when her sister Babs was like, hey, do you want to come train with me? And Ethel was like, sure. And she just had an aptitude for it. It was just something she fell into. So they were already, the sisters were already doing, just for fun, after school, they were like taking tumbling classes and like self-defense judo classes. So they already sort of had an aptitude for it. And then, so when they started professional, training professionally, they just took to it.
So was the training very similar to some of the stories you heard, like with the men, you know, where you were kept in the dark as to what's going on and they would kind of beat the daylights out of you a little bit until, you know, you stuck around long enough and then they smartened you up and said, okay, this is all work. Here's how it goes. Did they, was that the same process for the women?
Yeah. Ethel talks about how, I think she said Mae Young, she said was the first one she trained with. And she was like, they literally wanted to see how much you could take. It was like being in the military where they would just try to break you. And if they, you know, if they were able to break you and you ran away crying, then obviously you weren't meant to be a wrestler. But if you could take it and give as good as you got, then obviously you were going to be successful. Okay. And all those three sisters, they just, they gave as good as they got, definitely.
Yeah. So how did Billy Wolf discover Ethel? You said that she was
He recruited Babs. That part of the story, I don't know. Has passed. Babs passed. Both Babs and Marva passed away in 2003.
Okay.
So I don't know what was the first
interaction.
Yeah, interaction.
Like he didn't run into her somewhere and say, hey, you know, you would, you look pretty, like a strong
and it
lady.
Could have been like a cattle, you know, what they call a big audition where he just put an ad in the paper and started looking for wrestlers, and Babs just happened to see it.
So what were maybe some of the hardships or roadblocks that Ethel shared with you? I mean, going out on the road, you know, and I know that from being a wrestling nerd that, you know, many of the African-American male wrestlers faced a lot of racism and a lot of discrimination and horrible things, you know, intimidation and whatnot outside of the ring, out in the towns that they were in. So what did they face?
Yeah, Ethel talks about how much discrimination they faced. I mean, the thing is they would go to foreign countries, like they'd go to Australia or Japan, and a lot of times they would be hailed like queens or whatever. Although they did experience some racism overseas as well. But where it was really bad, of course, was the American South. I mean, because Billy Wolf Jr., Billy Wolf's son, would drive them around, sometimes they would get stopped for race mixing. If they saw a black person and a white person in a car together, it was like...
I never thought about that. Eye-opening. I never would have ever thought about that. I know that went on, but... So... I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Any other?
Yeah, and she talks about how, I think they were in Tuscaloosa, there was a group called the White Citizens Council, was just another term for the Ku Klux Klan, that were like, they were actually going to riot if they were like, don't let those black girls come on the mat. So the promoter, they had already sold all these tickets, and they weren't going to cancel the show, and they were like, well, we'll just take our chances. But Ethel and this other black woman who were supposed to wrestle kept hearing all this chaos going on outside the arena, and they were like, "We're leaving. We, you know, they're not going to hang us." So they had to sneak out and and forfeit their money. They didn't get paid, of course. So yeah, and there was a lot of times like that where they just had to give up their money and like, you know, our lives are not worth it. Wow. So they were literally risking their lives.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story. And, you know, I think the other thing that clicked in my head when you're talking about that, if you have a sold out arena, I mean, you know, I think it's history has told us, for an example, Bill Watts, you know, in Louisiana, the Junkyard Dog was making money and he didn't care if you were white or black.
Yeah.
If you were making green, that was fine, even though supposedly he had some racist tendencies.
Right.
So I just, when you said that, I would just have thought, like, it wouldn't matter. The promoter's making huge cash. Like, what difference would it make?
Yeah, but it was the same era where boxers, black boxers could only box in front of white audiences. Like, they wouldn't have integrated crowds for someone like Jack Johnson or Joe Louis. And Ethel talks about meeting Joe Louis, and Joe Louis became a big wrestling fan and started refereeing some of their matches. But it was just, that's the way it was. It was like, even like in entertainment, like the Cotton Club in Harlem, you had all black entertainers entertaining white people. It was like a minstrel show. So that's kind of how they saw it. It's like, you're here to entertain me, not we're equal and, open to the public. It's, you know, I am paying you to entertain me.
Yeah.
You know.
So when it went overseas, was it a little bit of a culture shock, not just from the idea that you're in another country, but you mentioned, you know, other countries were much more open-minded during this time period that they didn't see skin color. So was it a culture shock? Did they share anything about, like, was to be cheered and loved, and then you come back here and you're in Mississippi and they hate you?
Yeah, well, they both had the cheering, but they also had racism. So in a country like Australia, for example, the black women were very popular. But Ramona Isbell talks about going to a mall, you know, before the match started or whatever. She just was shopping to kill time. And she was, like, looking at an outfit, and the salesperson came up and was like, "I'd rather you not touch that." And she was like, "I'm going to buy it. I just wanted to see how it was made." And she was like, "Well, I would just rather you not touch it."
Okay.
Yeah, so she was still a black woman, even if she was a famous wrestler and had money to pay for
clothes. We could say maybe more subtle racism, maybe.
Yeah, but some of it was blatant. Like, Kim Martin, the daughter of Marva Scott, talked about how when her mother went to wrestle in Japan one time, the Japanese wrestlers, in order to throw her off of her game, kept saying, "Negro, Negro, pressy hair, pressy hair," you know, like as an insult.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's unfortunate. So let's talk a little bit some more about Billy Wolf. So one of the things that you mentioned was that he was married to Mildred Burke, and then they kind of had a divorce, and then that caused Billy to set up shop here in Columbus.
No, he set up shop while he was married to Mildred
Burke. Oh, that's right. Yes, he was. But he set up shop here in Columbus. That's right.
Yeah.
But then when they got divorced, things got a little bit ugly. And they had a competition going on. So how did that competition between, because Mildred set up her own promotion and they would go head to head. And in fact, I think in my research, the NWA kind of got really, really annoyed with constantly having to, I guess you could say, a referee their bickering at meetings and whatnot.
Yeah.
So did that impact the girls any? Did it impact Ethel and those ladies?
I don't know if it impacted the black women directly, but the fact that Mildred Burke and Billy Wolf were in competition with each other when they used to be working together is what kind of eventually caused the decline of women's wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of them just working together and saying, "Okay, let's try to cultivate the best female wrestlers that we can. I'll make my money," because Mildred eventually moved to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
"So I'll just stay out here." Mildred could have said, "I'll just stay out here on the West Coast and, you know, kind of tackle this region, and you handle the Midwest and the East." But they decided, they both, you know, they were both, I don't know if you could say Mildred was greedy, but Billy definitely was.
So
they both wanted all or nothing. So Jeff Lean, the Washington Post reporter, he talked about that, how the quality of the female wrestler started to go down because they weren't going through the training as much. It was became more about flash and about what outrageous things can they do in the ring to just draw as many people as possible.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you for a moment. So, you are obviously a wrestling fan.
Well, you know what's interesting? I'm not a wrestling fan per se. When I was a kid, you know, I grew up in the
80s.
So, I used to watch wrestling on TBS.
Okay.
So I would spend a lot of time over at my grandparents' house. So they had this room that they called the rec room in the basement.
Oh, yeah.
My grandparents were ahead of their time. They had cable TV when nobody else really did.
Okay.
So I would go over to their house and watch cable TV all the time. So I would watch, Ric Flair and Rowdy Roddy Piper, and I would kind of throw myself around the basement when I was in fifth and sixth grade.
Everyone
did. Yeah, yeah.
Everyone did.
Yeah, and then when I got to high school, I sort of outgrew it.
Okay.
And I mean, I hadn't thought about wrestling or anything until a friend of mine, most of my career has been as a print journalist. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine named Terry Anderson, another African-American man who works in public relations, he would give me story ideas, and he kept saying, Chris, you should interview this woman I grew up with. She had all these interesting people hanging out over her house, and I was friends with her daughter, and she had wrestlers and bodybuilders and actors hanging out over her house, and you should interview her sometime. So I sat that ended up being Ethel Johnson. So like I said, I hadn't thought about wrestling in years, and then all of a sudden just sitting down with her and hearing her stories, I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I wrote a story about her that came out in the Dispatch in March of 2006. And when the story came out, it was during the Arnold Classic. The Arnold Classic people called me up and they were like, wow, we never knew these female wrestlers existed. We'd like to give Ethel a Lifetime Achievement Award. So I called her and she was like, you know what? Tell them thanks, but no thanks. I'm retired now and I don't really want the attention.
But that still was a nice gesture, though. That was an amazing gesture.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just kind of thought, well, Ethel's story and the story of these other women shouldn't just die out with this one Dispatch article. So I thought it just naturally lent itself to a documentary. I'm not a classically trained filmmaker. I actually went to Fort Hays. I studied radio and TV there. Okay. So I do know a little bit about cameras and editing and stuff. But I hadn't gone to UCLA or NYU
right,
film school.
Right, yeah. And yeah. See, I was going to ask that about the how was the transition to going from, what you're used to, which is print journalism, to going to documentary filmmaking? Was the transition easy or tough? Or
It was easy and tough. Because I always wanted to be, I'll put it this way. I always wanted to be a storyteller.
Okay.
Meaning that I always saw myself as being an author and a filmmaker and a playwright and just telling stories in whatever medium made sense. Okay. So it wasn't unnatural for me to say, okay, now I'm going to make a movie, because I'd been dreaming of that since I was a kid. I was inspired by Spike Lee. Actually, a book I read that really inspired me was Rebel Without a Crew by Robert Rodriguez.
But I'm familiar with.
He talks about how he made El Mariachi with basically a camera and a tape recorder. He hadn't been to film school either. He'd made some short films, but he didn't have a film degree. So the technology I was using at the time was the mini DV tapes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a challenge, because it took me several years to finish this. So technology kept changing while I was making it. And sometimes I would do an interview with the wrestling ladies and, oh God, the sound didn't come out. So now I have to ask them to, do the interview again or what, which is actually, professional film shoots, they have to do reshoots sometimes.
Sure.
Really, what really saved me was a friend of mine that I went to Fort Hays with, Paul Hill. He's an editor at the Wexner Center in their film video studio program. And that's where filmmakers come in from all over the country and they basically give them free editing and post-production. So when I told Paul about this movie I was making, he was like, wow, that's amazing. Why don't you come to the Wexner Center? And they were awesome. So they did all the post-production. Paul did all the post-production.
Yeah, okay.
They took what I did on my Mac laptop on Final Cut software and cleaned it up and made it more professional and, cleaned up the sound. And so,
excellent. Yeah. Because you had said off air that you're kind of a one-man gang, so to speak, with this movie, because, you had to go and interview and you had to shoot everything and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine that the headaches that you may have ran across
except for some technical glitches, it went pretty smoothly. The ladies were always very cooperative, which is interesting. They don't really like a lot of attention, but I don't know, maybe I just have a way about me. I was able to get them to open up, and they were really cool and forthcoming. And
So going back to your fandom as a little kid, who were your favorites?
Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Really?
And I ended up interviewing him.
Really?
Yeah, and it's this really unusual story.
Okay.
So,
whoops. Go ahead. How'd you manage to hook that up?
So I grew up in an interracial family, and the reason why I mention that is because I have three white step parents. So I was exposed to all different kinds of cultural influences growing up. I didn't just grow up in the black community. So I grew up hearing all different kinds of music. So I'm a big metal fan. I like all different kinds of music, but I like heavy metal a lot.
Okay.
So I found out Lita Ford was going to be at this horror convention in Indianapolis. This was summer of 2013. So I'm like, oh, I'd love to meet Lita Ford. So I'm looking up the website, and I'm like, oh, Rowdy Piper's going to be there too, because he was there, the cast of They Live, you know, that horror movie.
Oh, yes, of course.
Was going to be doing some kind of reunion or something. Okay. So I'm like, oh, I should try to interview him for the documentary, Kill Two Birds with One Stone. Mm-hmm. So I get there, and I just get in line. You know, he's signing autographs. And I'm like, I'm making a movie about black female wrestlers. Do you happen to remember any of these women? He was like, oh, yeah, sure. Come back tomorrow, and I'll give you an interview. So I came back the next day. He was totally cool. Gave me a lot of good quotes. And then, of course, a couple years later, I'm in the process of finishing the movie and find out that he died.
Yeah, that was a big shock.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah, and I'm like, yeah. So I'm like, should I keep his comments in there? Is that too, you know, gruesome or whatever? But I decided to keep it in there and just, mm-hmm. you know, put a note that, you know, that yeah. he spoke to me a couple years before he died.
So he knew Ethel and some of the ladies?
Yeah.
Really?
He actually remembered Ramona really well.
Really?
Yeah, because I think he was Canadian, right?
Yes.
And they wrestled a lot in Canada.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he was out on the West Coast a lot, too, you know, in his early years. So that probably... Wow. I did not know that he would not... Again, this is so fascinating, Chris. I'm being honest. You know, as I said, and I'm just going to repeat, as being a big wrestling nerd...
Yeah.
Never really knowing that these ladies existed is just like eye opening for me.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's talk a little bit, a couple of other things real quick. You also are a co-author with a critically acclaimed nonfiction book. All jokes aside, comedy is a funny business.
Yeah.
So you want to tell the listeners a little bit about what that book is all about?
That was another opportunity that just kind of fell into my lap. So I wasn't necessarily looking to, I wrote a novel called The Chloe Chronicles, but I wasn't looking to like co-write a book or write a nonfiction mm-hmm. book. So I don't know if you're familiar with Will Haygood. He's a journalist who grew up in Columbus. He's actually now working on a book about East High School. But anyway, he's a journalist with the Washington Post, and he wrote the article that the movie The Butler with Oprah Winfrey and Forrest Whitaker mm-hmm. was based on.
Okay.
So we started out at the same newspaper in different decades. I was working at the Collin Post, which is a weekly African-American newspaper. That was my first newspaper job in the 90s. He worked there in the 80s. So when he would come home and visit his family in Columbus, he'd stop by the newspaper. And so I sort of struck up an acquaintanceship with him. So Raymond Lambert, who owned All Jokes Aside, the club that the book is based on, there was a documentary that was made about the club called Funny Business. And so Raymond was like, well, the documentary didn't really capture everything. I want to write a book that just kind of talks about how I grew up in poverty, was the first in my family to go to college. He became an investment banker and then just started this second career as a comedy club owner. So he called Will Haygood at the Washington Post and was like, I just read your book about Sugar Ray Robinson. It blew my mind. Would you be willing to collaborate on this book with me about my life story? Will Haygood was like, I'm actually writing a script right now called The Butler, but a friend of mine in Columbus that started out the same newspaper would probably be interested.
Okay.
So when Raymond called me, I was like, why is Will giving out my number to people? But when Raymond started talking about his club, and I mean, it was in Chicago in the 90s.
Sure. Yeah.
So pretty much you can name any famous black comedian, Chris mm-hmm. Rock, Dave Chappelle, Steve Harvey. They got their start, even Carlos Mencia. So,
mm-hmm.
so yeah, it was amazing.
Did you get to interview any of those folks?
I didn't personally interview those people, but actually Raymond gave me all the transcripts from the documentary. So it was really cool just hearing all these stories. And like Steve Harvey actually crashed on Raymond's couch one time when he was working at the comedy club. And so just hearing some of these backstage stories was really cool.
Those are always fascinating. I always enjoy those backstage stories, either we're talking about movies or wrestling or anything. Like hearing that stuff is really cool. We'll talk a little bit about the Chloe Chronicles, because that's your novel there, and let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was actually inspired. I grew up, I went to Catholic school up through 8th grade. I went to Holy Spirit in Whitehall. So every day after school, I would go to the Whitehall Library, which was right across the street. And there was this book called Bizu by an author named Norma Klein. She was a really, really, really popular young adult author when I was growing up. She had a book called Mom, the Wolfman, and Me, and a lot of her books were like turned into, you know, made for after-school specials and stuff.
Okay.
So there was this book called Bizu about a biracial girl who's part French and part black. Like, her mother's a black fashion model who moved to Paris to model, and like she never knew her father, who was a white American. So that kind of, the book kind of caught my attention because I grew up in an interracial family. So that inspired this book called Chloe, about a biracial girl whose mother is a black woman from New Orleans who's like French Creole. My family has Creole heritage too. Okay. And Chloe never knew her father, who's a white Frenchman. So Chloe is sort of like curious about her identity and goes on this quest to kind of find out where she came from.
Has it been well received?
Yeah, I mean, I self-published it, so it's always hard,
but, and that's one of the things about being independent. You don't have the machine behind you to push it out, but has it been well received to those folks that have stopped by?
Yeah, I mean, actually,
grab the copy wherever you were
at. It's definitely, like, the people who that I've been able to get it into their hands are, like, passionate fans, like, oh my god, I stayed up reading this all night. So I'm actually going to be relaunching it like a new edition sometime next year.
Is there going to be, is it, when you say a new edition, a whole new story?
Or no, I'm just
going to kind of just a new, I don't know, the director's cut, so to speak, if you
will. Yeah, you know what's interesting is I always say I did the director's cut in reverse because the original, the current version of the novel is like over 600 pages. So I'm like, I should cut this down to try to get more of an audience. So it's going to be probably like in the 500 page range. So I'm just going to relaunch it and just kind of try to get more publicity and get more people to read it.
Gotcha.
Now the Kindle books are really popular.
Yeah, on
Amazon. Right. It's I'm not going to say easy, but it's, you can find a niche audience for something that you're trying to promote easier than when back in 2012 when I first published it.
Sure. Yeah. So you're a Columbus guy, born and raised.
Born and raised. Yeah.
What makes Columbus the best place to be in regards to being creative and an artist, in your opinion?
I think Columbus is just like, it's a microcosm of the country. It's like you have urban areas like Columbus that tend to be a little more liberal, where my step-grandparents, my white step-grandparents are from in Mount Gilead, you know, which is an hour north of here.
Yeah.
That's Trump country. So I grew up seeing all sides. I mean, so I think I was a huge, huge, huge Prince fan growing up. I mean, in my whole entire adult life too. So one thing that I always related to was that Prince never left Minneapolis. It was like he saw Minneapolis as this place where he had the best of both worlds. There were all these creative people that were undiscovered because they didn't live in Los Angeles or New York. And I see Columbus as the same way. There's all these, there's a filmmaking community. There's a huge music scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned there's a podcast.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you 100%. We talked off air. Yeah, I think, you know, there's so many great creative people in Columbus that have created these small little pockets, if you will, whether it's podcasting, whether it's filmmaking or whatnot. I totally get that. Yeah. I totally understand. Yeah. It is kind of the best of both worlds, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back real quick to talk about the ladies here. Should they be in the Hall of Fame?
Absolutely. And they've gotten offers. Like Ethel has gotten other offers to be inducted into Halls of Fame. So it's not... Jeff Ling says in the documentary that the wrestling industry has amnesia about these women, like they're kind of purposely out of racism or whatever, kind of turning a blind eye. That's not completely true, because there have been offers over the years to induct some of the women into halls of fame. A lot of it was just sort of circumstances. Number one, Billy Wolf kind of, you know, after his death, the women just kind of fading into obscurity and deciding they weren't going to continue. Number two, a lot of the women being married, and sometimes it was their husbands who didn't want them to have the attention anymore. And then a combination of, also like Ramona, she became a born-again Christian. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to talk about that part of my life anymore. So it was a combination of just plain passage of time, and number two, the women just kind of deciding, well, I don't want the limelight anymore. I don't want to pursue that anymore.
What do you think, and I don't know, maybe you asked, Ethel, maybe you didn't, what's their opinion of women's wrestling today?
They hate it.
Really?
They're like, it's nothing but TNA. They're like, it's nothing like how we did it. They're like, when you're watching a wrestling match now, you're watching a movie. They're like, it's choreographed. We were athletes. I mean, they have respect for anyone who pursues a dream and wants to be successful in wrestling. So they're not necessarily putting down the individual wrestlers. They're just saying, back in my day, you know, we trained for hours and hours and hours. We didn't have any of these chemical things that people use, bodybuilders and wrestlers use now to enhance their muscles or whatever. We were getting medicine balls thrown in our stomach. You know, everything we did was manual. We didn't have these machines that like assisted you. I mean, it was like everything we did was like, you know, hand against stone. And they're like, Everything is so easy now. The WWE is just like, they're making way more money than we ever made.
Yeah.
They don't really have a favorable... And some of the rest... I interviewed this wrestling fan named Kenneth Clark, and he's like, wrestling is not the same. When I see it, it just doesn't look the same as...
And I think that is a valid argument. I think that, you know, even on the men's side of things, uh-huh. Yeah, there's just not that same... I don't know. There's something different about it back yeah. in the day. You know, there was. I don't know. We could sit here and probably talk for another hour about how wrestling has changed yeah. over the years. But I could see where they're coming from. Yeah, most definitely. There's something
yeah.
different to it.
But you could take any industry and say the right. same thing. Sure. You could take Motown musicians who would say
yep.
the music industry is nothing like how we didn't have auto-tune. We didn't have
yeah.
you know we right. didn't have iTunes. People actually went out and bought records. They didn't steal it by downloading it online.
Sure. Or whatever. Yeah. Oh yeah. And then. Definitely agree with you that there any industry you can
yeah.
plug right in there. Or any, like the NBA.
That's yeah, absolutely.
That's a common thing I hear about. Yeah. It was better back in the day
yeah, yeah.
than so, it is today. So, yeah. I think it's not just something that is just for pro wrestling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I think people in general have a tendency to romanticize the past.
Sure.
It's interesting because, like, in a way, they're romanticizing it and saying it was better back then, but there's also a lot of painful memories.
That's the paradox right
yeah,
there. That's
yeah,
the paradox.
Yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, so, Chris, last couple of things here.
Yeah.
The movie right now, you can find out about it by going to, if I remember correctly, ladywrestlermovie.com, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And also, right. as soon as I am able to confirm the date for the big screening in Columbus, I will definitely announce it. There and also my website chrisbornet.com.
Okay. Do you have any other social media that you would like to?
Yeah,
let?
You can Twitter and Facebook under okay. my name Chris Bornet.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
Chris, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to just tell the listeners real quick about your project or about these wonderful women and how
yeah.
amazing they were?
Yeah, what I would say is that I just think it's interesting that this story about women, and we're hearing so much now in the media about men behaving badly, to say the least. But it was really men like myself and Terry Anderson, another man, who decided to make this story about women. Billy Wolf, he was a man. He was complex. You know, he was not a saint by any means. But Jeff Lean, he's a man. He wrote a book about Mildred Burke. So there are men who are interested in women's stories. And real quickly, I'll just tell you, I went to WrestleCon in Orlando back in April.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I went to one of the women's matches, and I interviewed some of the male wrestling fans afterward, and I was like, why are you here? Why are you interested in women's wrestling? These men were the most egalitarian fans of any sport that I've ever talked to. I can't imagine going to a football game where women were playing and men saying, oh yeah, these women kick ass. We love seeing
them.
Yeah. We love
right.
seeing
sure.
the women play football. These men were like, these women are great. They deserve more attention than they're getting. They can, you know, hold their own right up there with the men. None of these men would call themselves feminists. But I just think wrestling is a sport that it's like sort of an even playing field, and wrestling doesn't get the credit for that. Wrestling fans are, if you can wrestle, you can wrestle. Doesn't matter if you're black, white, female, or male.
Yeah. All right, Chris. Man, thanks for coming on.
Thank
I appreciate you. It, man.
This
was
great.
You know?
This was my first official podcast.
Really?
Yeah, I've never been on a podcast
before. Oh, well, man, I'm glad that I could give you your first experience.
Yeah.
As weird as that sounded.
A little awkward, yeah.
That was a little awkward, wasn't it? That was very Weinstein-like, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Since exactly, yeah.
But in all seriousness, folks,
yeah.
LadyWrestlerMovie.com, check it out. Chris, thanks for coming on. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
All right, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up this episode. So, if you will, please stick around. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Bornet and myself talking about his movie, Lady Wrestler, The Amazing Untold Story of African-American Women in the Ring, as we met in, I believe it was November, I want to say November, but in the fall of last year, and we talked about his movie as it got wrapped up, and now it's going to be part of a big screening, a big premiere, if you will, once again at the Wexner Center for the Arts here in Columbus, Ohio, 7 o'clock on March 29th. You don't want to miss it, ladies and gentlemen. If you're interested, go to wexarts.org to get tickets. Tickets are only $8 or $6 if you're a student, a kid, or senior citizen. And come on out and see a great documentary. I also need you, the listeners of the PVDcast, to give me some feedback. Because I'm thinking about doing a few more of these encore presentations. But I think that one of the problems
is that some folks may not want to listen to an episode that's kind of basically pulled from another episode. So, you know, I know it's a kind of a double-edged sword, so to speak. So I need your input. I need you to let me know whether I should do this again or should I just forget about it and never do this again. And you can do that a couple different ways. First, you can email me, johnorlando@pvdcast.com. You can let me know on Twitter, @pvdmvp. You could even leave me a message over on the Facebook page of this podcast. That, of course, being facebook.com/pvdcast. And, of course, this podcast is available to you a variety of different ways. Obviously, you can get it at pvdcast.com, the online home of yours truly. But it's also available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, SoundCloud, Pod Paradise, and, of course, the Echo Network. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here, so I'll chat at each and every one of you later. Until next time, stay righteous and stay independent.